Setting up shop.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Setting Up Shop. It's another episode hosted by myself, Dan, a woodturner from the UK, Erasmus, a blacksmith from Norway.
Hello.
And Heidi, a potter from America.
Hey, hey, hey.
So, as always with this podcast, we're doing our best to share from our experience and in things we've learned about taking your craft, your hobby, the thing that you love doing towards being a business. Sometimes that could be scary, sometimes it could be fun, or all of the above, and lots of other emotions as well. Today we are going to talk a bit about what motivates you to sell in the first place. So you found this hobby, you've been doing it for a little while, and your craft, whatever you want to call it. And you're making things, and you've probably been asked a number of times, oh, how much would you sell that for? Or can I have that? And whatever. And it's normally by friends and family, so you don't necessarily take it too seriously to begin with. But motivation to sell can be daunting, and it can also throw up some resistance, particularly if you see yourself more as an artist or a craftsperson who feels that maybe it dilutes the art that they're doing, or it makes it feel dirty or wrong in some way to put a monetary value against something that you're creating. So we're gonna talk a bit about that today. And it should be a good conversation. And if it's not, quite frankly, we'll delete it and record something else so you never know. So first of all, then, really, it's here's something for you all to think about. So selling isn't an interruption of your craft. It's the fuel that allows the craft to continue. So not interruption of your craft. It's not a hold on a minute. I'm in the middle of doing this thing and it's interrupted my flow. Oh, now I've got to sell this thing, or it's making you feel it cheapens it or anything like that. It is the fuel that allows your craft to continue, because regardless of whether you're still in full-time employment or whether you've got a significant other or family who are supporting you, there is a cost to doing your craft, no matter how big or small it is. Now, the three of us here are all at a stage where that cost is probably a bit bigger than other people's, certainly when it comes to equipment that I use and the amount invested in that, and Heidi with things like her kiln and the workspace on the back of her house, and Rasmus obviously doing it full time. That's a little bit bigger than most people, but it's also, we're at a stage that some people are still striving for. So you have to accept the fact that there is a cost, there needs to be monetary value coming in to allow you to feel relaxed about expanding your craft or moving on to next steps, whether that's learning more, so paying for training, buying more equipment, buying more materials, whatever the case is. So selling your work can absolutely be the fuel that allows the craft to continue. That doesn't mean it's always easy. So a little bit in the pre-show, we've been talking, which isn't recorded. However, the after show is recorded and is available on Patreon. So if you haven't subscribed to Patreon for us, totally understand. It's a difficult time at the moment, but you can subscribe for free to get notifications of new episodes. And there's a very nominal fee that you could pay in order to listen to the after show section as well. We'll share some more things, probably be a bit more relaxed in the way we talk as well. And potential for some of you, in case you have delicate ears, that there may be more swearing from some people in the chat. Just to be aware. But hey, maybe that's what you want. Go to Patreon, find out. No, there's no spicy content. So,
are you sure?
Well, not so far, unless you've been doing extra Patreon recordings as well.
I mean, anything to drive the numbers up, right?
I'm going to walk away from that one there, as it's we'll refer to earlier in the conversation about the things you do in your craft that make you feel dirty. So, okay, since you're being the most vocal first, Rasmus, we'll come to you with the question first. Why would you, if you've spent a huge amount of time crafting something at the anvil, so you spent 15, 20 hours making something, you've designed it, you spent a lot of time creating it, why would you then hesitate to post it for sale or add a monetary value to it? And I know I'm asking the wrong person, because you wouldn't at all.
There is cases where I do struggle with that, but that is mostly for like prototypes, or like I spend an absurd amount of time trying to make this and figure out how to make it. And I only have like the one or two items to show for it. And I don't have like a basis to actually put a quote unquote a production price for it. Or it's something I made as an experiment and it's not meant for sale. But then again, if I don't sell it or don't put it, it goes in the scrap bin, or it just takes up space that I would rather use for things I know I can sell.
Okay.
So usually I don't have an issue because like I do a lot of production work, but I also do sometimes manage to somehow find time to have fun. And then it's, I have a thing, but I don't actually know the value of it because I only made the one and I spent far too much time like thinking about how to make it.
So from the prototype perspective, there's probably no emotional attachment to that that's stopping you from selling it. It's just, okay, this is my find my way piece. It's probably a bit ugly, but I will keep it to one side because if I get asked to make another one of these, I can take it off the shelf and look at it again and refer to my notes in my notebook and make sure that I understand all the processes. That's the one aspect of it. But the other ones that you've just mentioned, which are your, oh, okay, this is a nice thing. This is my first one of many kind of nice thing. That's a different element because that's now got an emotional attachment to it.
Yeah, and that does happen. There's like a couple of the first swords I made, which were client work, is kind of like, but this one turned out nice. I kind of want to keep it now. But I don't have the time to make another one for the actual client. I need to give them the nice one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can understand on pieces like that, that sometimes you can be reluctant to let it go. But the question though, the follow-up to that is, because you've been doing this for long enough now and made a huge amount of products and sold them on, do you even necessarily remember, do you have those moments where people come back to you and you're like, vaguely familiar, where do I know you from? And they're like, oh, you made this thing for me like 6 years ago and I really loved it. And then you suddenly go, oh, yeah. And you go, oh, yeah, actually, I really liked that at the time, didn't I? Do you have those moments?
No, I completely forget about everything.
Excellent.
I have had people come up to me, including friends of mine, really, really good friends of mine, that I have done things for custom for like their cabin and things. And they ask me like, so we finally put it up. And then go like, what? Oh, the drying rack over the oven. I was like, cool. When did I do that for you? And granted, at that point, it might have been like 2 years, 3 years between I made it and I actually put it up. So it's like complete detachment from my mind. But yeah.
Yeah, I think in your case, because you've been running it as a business for what, over a decade now?
12 years this year.
Yeah, exactly. So so that then means that the attitude you have, even if it's a carefully made thing for certain people, can be, you're a bit more flexible when it comes to, oh yeah, this has this value or this has that value and whatever else. Yeah, that's fair enough. What about yourself, Heidi? Do you have those moments where you've made those pieces and you're like,
Maybe not the client work, because typically with pottery, you have to like make duplicates while you're working just in case somewhere along the line something goes wrong. But when it comes to the raku that I have only sold a couple of those pieces. And that's partially because I'm attached to them and I made them for myself. Like the goal going in wasn't, this is a commodity. Yeah. The goal going in was, I love raku. I have this vision. I want to make this piece. It's for me. Now I've had other things go in the raku fire and maybe I made like four forms that were all the same. And I chose the one that like just had that like little flavor to it that stood out from the other ones. And I'm like, well, I'm going to keep this one and then I'm going to sell the other ones. Yeah. And that's usually just because, you know, you're allowed, you know, you're allowed to make things for yourself. You're allowed to have things that are precious to you that, you know, you put on the shelf and you say, oh, remember that time I made that? Or, you know, I've kept things that I did when I was doing an experience, right? Like maybe I was working with other potters or, you know, took a class or whatever. So the goal in mind was to learn and, you know, the result maybe when other people look at it, they're like, why do you want to keep that? But for me, like Rasmus, like you were saying, like there's some kind of emotional attachment, whether it tells a story of where I was at that point in time as a potter, or it reminds me of the people that I was with and the experience that I had. There's like tie-ins there, but I think there's multiple reasons why I keep some things, but there's multiple reasons why I smash others. I'm like, I can't sell that. This is a piece of shit. Yeah, people say, I want that.
No, I think it's gone to fire. Yeah. It's, I think what we're talking about here is the fact that all three of us have had the mindset shift, and it's the difference between making something for the fun and love of making it and making something that you still enjoy making, but the purpose of making the thing is for money. And I think it's really important for people to realize that it is possible to make things and enjoy making them, but your intention is to sell them right from the get-go.
Yes.
There is a very subtle difference between, oh, I'm going to make something for a friend who I know will love this thing that I'm going to do. They don't know I'm making it for them, and it allows you to explore your creativity, and there is never any intention of asking for a financial recompense for it. That is different from, hey, I've made this really cool thing that lots of people seem to like, and I can see the joy in their faces when they pick it up, or they see it, or they love the tactile nature of it, or whatever the case may be. And I enjoy making it, and I enjoy that response from the person that I can physically see. But I also know that I can make them to a price point that means I'm actually generating revenue for my craft. That doesn't necessarily mean profit, but it you know, you're at least paying for the piece in your time, and maybe a little bit more towards more materials or whatever the case may be. And that is a mindset shift, but I think it is one that is relatively easy to do once you've got over the initial fear or concern of actually putting a value to your piece, which we've spoken about in previous episodes and previous seasons. This is season 6. If you haven't heard the previous 5 seasons, they are available on your latest podcast recording app. Unless you're listening to this in a post-apocalyptic world, in which case this might be the only episode that you can listen to on repeat. And I feel sorry for you if that is the case, but I digress. If you are in that stage, then so you've managed to hopefully get over the point of working out how to charge for something, which, you know, that could be helped by other people in your community. The next portion of it that a lot of us have potentially struggled with is this idea that you have to, if you've made a piece or you've made a series of pieces, that you have to then get to a point where you're happy getting rid of said pieces. And the way you can change that mindset a little bit is to recognize the fact that you're not getting rid of a bowl or a blade or a mug. You are allowing it to find a home where it will be appreciated. Because the reality is, all of us have stock or inventory that kind of piles up a little bit, and it will be sat on a shelf or in a box, and we forget about it. And then we'll take it out occasionally. We go, oh, yeah, that's when I made this thing, and you know, kind of reminisce. But that's nowhere near the same as allowing someone else to take that thing that is potentially utilitarian and meant to be used, or is a source of joy and is therefore going to bring, you know, joy to other people. So that allows you to kind of move those things on. So you've got to remember that is an element that someone else could enjoy this, and someone else may pay you to be able to enjoy that thing. And also that gives you validation, because it's the ultimate compliment in some way, because, you know, someone's spent their time to earn money, and then they've taken that money to pay you for the time you've spent making a thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, validation is quite an important one for a lot of us. I know it is definitely for me, and I'm getting nods from my two co-hosts there.
I got to say, maybe one of the biggest pieces of validation I got was when one of the older professional blacksmiths in Norway reached out to me and wanted to buy one of the leaf bowls I made.
Yeah.
Not because necessarily he wanted it, but his wife saw it and go like, oh, I want that.
Oh, no.
And by all means, he agreed with her. He also thought it was really, he really appreciated it and also wanted it. But he was kind of like, I could make it. But she realized that, no, we'll buy it from him. He is young. He's up and coming. Support him. And he was like, yes, ma'am, I will.
Aww, that's nice.
See, that's really nice. But it also, I mean, it highlighted for me, I can remember having probably an hour and a half conversation where I was really confused with yourselves and a bunch of other maker friends as to why I really couldn't grasp the concept as to why another wood turner bought one of my cake stands. And not only did they buy it, they bought it at full retail from my website. And I was just like, really? Why? You can make this. Like, why have you, like, you know, you're down the road from me. Not only can you make this, but you didn't say, hey, can I have one of those? And like, I, you know, not ask for discount, but I potentially would have given you some. But they were like, no, I want this thing as because it's been made by you. And I still, to a certain extent, struggle with that.
That's, I have an easy time buying other potters' work, but it's always a shock to me when other potters want my work.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Like, I've had that similar experience, but I sell in a retail shop and I don't always see who's buying my work.
Yeah.
And then I was at an event and a potter came up to me and she's like, my husband bought me X Y piece that you made. And I love it so much. I use it every day. And I'm like, what? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I love you.
Yeah. It's a weird thing, isn't it? Because that's an interesting point you made, actually, because I'm more than happy going around and buying up a wood turner's work if it's a style that I wouldn't make or if it's a technique that I don't have. And sometimes, I'll be honest, sometimes I'll buy a small piece because I'm like, oh, I need to recognize this form and put it in my reference library because I am probably going to copy this at some point.
But I've had people like that as well. I've had people come into a class of mine and get really into blacksmithing and also really appreciate how much work something is. And they bought like a shoehorn from me and go like, I love the shape of this. And if you don't mind, I will buy this from you and try to copy it.
Yeah.
And I'll say, please do, and good luck. Yeah. Like, I'll spin the questions you have.
I think the pottery community, it's a little like, it depends on some potters, how precious they are about their design or their technique, or, you know, as much as a lot of the community feels very open about what they're doing, like as soon as you start copying the work or, you know, replicating it, maybe not copying it to like one-to-one, but you're, you know, obviously inspired by so-and-so person. There's a lot of folks online that get, you know, upset about it. Like, oh, you're infringing on their copyright in that sense. So it's
a slippery slope in that sense. I think the pottery community, because it is such a broad community and because so much of it can be quickly taken up by commercial venture. So, you know, you can see someone who goes, oh, I really like, I mean, I'll take an example from the UK. You know, I really like the stoneware from the Muchmere Pottery. And realistically, someone else can make a stoneware jug or a stoneware mug and use a similar slip, and it will look kind of the same. It's not easy, but it's easier probably to make things look similar enough that someone who doesn't know wouldn't know the difference. And then they're potentially paying for a piece that isn't from that location. And so I can imagine why, when it is so, you know, is so commercialized and used by so many different places, why that would be higher risk of people being upset with you. Whereas I think certainly in the wood turning community, I mean, there's only so many shapes of bowl, you know, like, and the reality is when you're talking like stairway spindles, now I need to know how this other person did it because they're going to die at some point and I'm like 20 years younger and then a spindle is going to get broken and then someone's going to come to me to ask how to replicate it. And I'm going to go, do you know what? I haven't got a clue because they gatekeep the hell out of the technique and no one knows how they did it. And I kind of feel like, you know, possibly because wood turning and blacksmithing haven't necessarily been as widely available and popular as something like pottery or sewing, that there may be less of that kind of risk of, oh, that's copyright infringement of what I was doing. Because I don't think that there's been quite as much, and I'm happy to be proved wrong on this, so people please reach out to us or put in the comments. I don't think there's been as much adaptation of new technologies to move along processes. Like that, there are certain things that through blacksmithing or wood turning that have become easier because certain technologies have got better, but it hasn't necessarily revolutionized the slip or the finish kind of idea like you might have with pottery. I know there's some stuff in wood turning finishing wise that some people have gone, oh, this has made a massive difference. All they're talking about is how much easier it is to get it shiny. Mm. You know, like the one in wood turning that would revolutionize is the person who comes up with the finish that is absolutely food safe, but doesn't make something look like it's plastic. And you can put hot food or hot liquids into it and it doesn't wear it away. That's the unicorn that would, like, if someone could come up with that product and they could bottle it and make it readily available, that would be the thing that would get copied the hell if people could work that formula out. But I'm not aware of anyone who's able to actually produce that yet. And I'm sure in blacksmithing as well, there's probably a thing. Like, I can remember a few years back when Mount Philip Metalworks did the Dragon Tail bottle opener. That was the one. And a lot of people were getting upset when other people were doing it. And he like publicly said, like, I've shown people how to make it in a video. Like, that's the whole point.
I'm not so precious of it, right?
Yeah.
There's been a couple of things like that. The Dragon Tail is one. I believe there was some, like, uproar about tentacle bottle openers doing a thing years back. Yeah. Before, I think even before John started making them.
Yeah.
John D. Harvey of JDH Metalcraft, I think, on Instagram. My opinion is, partly, I don't consider myself a good enough designer slash blacksmith that I think I have invented anything new. I'm pretty sure that everything I have made is more or less stolen somewhere else. So I'm not precious about any of that. But also, I don't think there's that much new in design being invented that hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
It's all borrowed from other places or other medium and then translated into, for example, blacksmithing. So again, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, you might be the first who did that in steel, but they've been doing that in pottery for like eons.
Yeah.
So
that's the benefit of the internet, though, isn't it? Is that all of a sudden, whereas in the past you would have had someone who was a craftsman or an artist, probably more of an artist, who found or watched a different medium and was able to then translate some of those techniques into their own medium. And everyone would like, wow, like, where did this come from? How did you do that? And they might have kept it to themselves. Whereas now, the internet's like, play with everything. Come on, have a look and see all this stuff. And like, people can go, oh, actually, do you know what? Sandblasting in wood turning. Where's this come from? Well, you've just turned this like beautiful hollow form, and now you shove it in a sandblaster, and now you can get this really like antiquing texture on the piece, and it will rake away all of the softer sections of the wood and leave the harder grain, and it can then make it look like, you know, it's a vase found in ancient Egypt and all of this kind of thing. So now you've got a different spin on exactly the same thing that's been made for a couple of hundred years. All of that kind of stuff is just, you know, you're finding those little twists and tweaks, but being able to do all of that can only really come from funding your craft.
Yep.
And so,
way to bring it back around, Dan.
Well, I've got to try somehow. It can only come from funding your craft. And the way you have to do that is you've got two ways of funding your craft. One is to find a really happy sponsor. The other one is
the Medici family.
Yeah. And the other one is to sell your stuff. And we've spoken about demonstrations and teaching. Obviously, that strings of revenue as well. But selling items you've made, you know, it's a big thing. And I think it's important to, when you go to markets, because that's where, you know, this is whole season one was all about, and season two as well, and all of this, taking your stuff to a market. If you go to that rather than selling in a shop, look around you, see what other people are doing or selling, and, you know, don't judge them for it. And don't look down on them, but ask questions. If they're willing to share and, you know, have a conversation with you, you've got to be aware that they may feel that you're trying to steal secrets from them, and not everyone likes it. But otherwise, like, oh, cool, that's really interesting. How did you do that? How did you form that shape? How was this done? Or, hey, you know, I'm a whatever type of creative person you are, I'm really intrigued because I'm looking at this process to do that. I mean, Heidi, you work a lot with like the lasers and the 3D print and that kind of stuff to suddenly make your relief stamps and stuff like that. I mean, you know, that's got to be a change that happened, you know, once that technology became available to potters at home. That's got to have been something that's made a difference to the way people do things.
Oh, for sure. And it's, I think, you know, historically, it was something that you would have to like go have a plate made and, you know, do all of these expensive investments to be able to make something that is replicatable, like making molds or those kind of things. And having a setup where you have this technology at your fingertips, I think is incredible. It makes things cleaner. It gives you crisper lines. You can get more detail, tighter, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, is it really like, it's shaved off time, but is it really that much different than what people have been doing for centuries, taking a rock and impressing it into the clay,
or a potato,
a texture, or a potato.
a potato.
But like, to me, the way that my brain works is I love technology. I love being able to figure things out electronically. I love design. I love all that stuff. But I also love pottery, and homogenizing those things together has given me my voice as a maker that's maybe let me stand out a little bit from somebody that doesn't have an interest in all that technology, right? Yeah. Like, I'm able to offer something, and this kind of goes back to your like having a column of things that are for sale. Like, my pitch is, I can take your logo, I can take an illustration, I can take whatever, and I can put that on a mug and replicate it 100 times. and you can use that as marketing for your business. But then I have this other column of these are things that I want to experience as an artist, as a maker, as you know, I'm still trying to find my artistic voice. That's my other column of if these sell, great. If they don't, I don't care. If I love them and want to keep them, again, there's no loss in the business. There's no loss financially. There's more than enough gain intellectually where I can take some of that methodology. Like there was a term, I can't remember what the term was, but when I was in art school, they were talking about people, when they would make something, they would see imperfection in what they were making, but they want to replicate that imperfection because that is the voice of the piece, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So taking that imperfection and figuring out how can I make that happen over and over and over again? Whether that's like adjusting a firing technique, adjusting how you're holding your lathe tool, you know, like chattering and those kind of things are considered, you know, detrimental to a design.
Yeah.
But chattering in a certain way gives you a visual that's like really, really interesting.
There's a guy at the moment in wood turning who's, you know, he's getting a lot of people at the moment to buy the, I can't remember the name of the tool, but it's the tool for removing excess weld spatter. So, and he's using it to texture wood turned items.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it looks really cool.
One called a Stevie tool. The Stevie tool has, it's like, it's a wheel, but it has spikes in it that you can adjust like the gaps between each of them. And you can like make it wider or shorter or whatever. And then while the wheel is turning, you can put it into the piece and it creates that like pattern texture. And just by tweaking a few little things with it, you can get like different depths and that kind of thing. So like all of that to say like those issues that you work out in those prototypes that Rasmus was telling you about. Like you may not be precious about those prototypes. You don't want to sell them because they are prototypes and they're not what you want in the world for what resembles you as a creative, for what resembles you as a maker, because they're not high enough quality, maybe is your perception. But what comes out of that, you know, what column does that end up falling in? Is that just for learnings and fine art, or is that sellable and usable for your like business part? Yeah. I think that's the really tough dichotomy that we have.
It's the part you kind of referred to as well, is the fact that if you don't charge enough to cover your shop overhead, your time, your materials, the power for the machinery, if you've got any of the finishes, all that kind of stuff.
And then the time to actually screw around and discover new things.
Then you basically end up with what you've got is an expensive hobby that will lead to burnout. If you're calling it a business, but you're not charging the right things to cover all of that, and again, we've spoken about this in previous episodes, we're not going to necessarily go over that again here, then you have an expensive hobby that can lead to burnout and can make you feel like a failure, and then can make you fall out of love with your hobby, which is a horrible, horrible thing. You know, you've got to be aware that why are you doing this? Going back to the title, what is your motivation to sell these items, these pieces? Oh, well, it's because I want to further my hobby and my craft. And then as Rasmus has just said, great. So you then need to make sure in part of your whole business plan, your timetable, that you allow time for you to actually play. You allow time for you to have a look at your craft. And maybe even like, you know, if you take on a commission, you use it as an excuse to play with a technique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like someone says, oh, can you make this thing for me? And you say to them, okay, well, do you mind how it's decorated? And they say, no, not really. It just needs to fulfill this thing. And you go, great. And you know, not to say you then give them a discount because you're going to play, but you can get paid to play with something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can then create a design and go, what do you think of this? And if they don't like it, it doesn't matter. You've had a go, you understood, and you can make the next stage. So there's definitely worthwhile remembering, why are you doing this? What is your motivation to sell? What's your motivation for then the business? Oh, it's because I want to pay for my craft to get better at my craft. And I want to expand my horizons. I want to have a look at different things.
I want to clean out my cabinet.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to make space on my workbench. I want to make space in this cupboard. If I make space in this cupboard, I can get rid of this cupboard, which means I can fit another machine in there. Oh, that's a motivator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever the case of that might be. Or I can fit another 10 anvils in this corner if I sell this one thing over here.
If I stack the anvils really nicely.
I can make a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some interesting alliteration here. There's what you could call the blacksmith's burden, or the potter's prayer, or the woodturner's woe. And I haven't thought of one for sewing people yet. But
sewing shit.
The physical toll that all of these crafts actually take on you, you know, the way you sit at a potter's wheel, the way that you have to hunch over an anvil or hunch over a lathe, or the physical lifting and moving of the heavy stock before you're actually moving things, your eyesight as you're staring at burning metal, all of that kind of stuff, that needs to be compensated. And it's not just, oh, well, the compensation, you know, the reward is that you get to make a piece that you really enjoy. Yeah, but if you're then selling that piece, then what is the compensation? Yeah. You are, through something that you're passionate about and everything else, putting your body through things that most people, I was going to use the word normal then, most people wouldn't choose to put themselves through repeatedly. Like, you know, you'll have people come on a class with you and they go, oh yeah, that was good fun. Then they won't think about it again, or they might tell other people that they should do it, but they won't like go, oh, well, now I need to actually buy a workshop space and invest money in things, move a lot of heavy stuff around to then dedicate hours and years of my life to try and perfect a thing and breathe in dust, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. There is a cost. There is a toll on your bodies. And hopefully you manage that in such a way that you don't get yourself broken by a young age. But that's definitely something that has to be considered. I mean, Rasmus, you probably more than all of us, even though you're the youngest one here, you're the one who moves the heaviest amount of stuff. And a shout out to Stian, who's helped you move all of that heavy stuff at least twice now. Or is it three times?
No, Stian has actually only helped once.
Okay. And that was enough. He then understood and was washing his hair the other times.
Yes. But I have moved workshop a few times, and other friends of mine have helped out a great deal.
Yeah, because I know I myself and others have bullied you about getting like a chain hoist or a forklift and other such stuff so that you don't just end up throwing your back out at some point.
Yeah, and I have an engine hoist now that has a 2-ton capacity, and that helps a fair bit.
Excellent. That's nearly enough to lift one corner of your power hammer off the floor.
No, it takes the power hammer, actually. Okay. I'm not sure if the engine hoist reaches high enough, but my power hammer is only like a ton, 1,300 kilos maybe.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ignoring even just the tool side of my business, even just the whole thing of picking up like 30 mil square and moving that around in 6-meter lengths and cutting that down and making railings and like manhandling things that actually products. That's still a lot.
Yeah. And you're doing that repeatedly throughout the day, and then being an insane person and going off and dancing. So you're doing the weightlifting and cardio all in the same time.
He's got good heart
health. And then people go, why does he eat so much? It's like, because if he didn't, he wouldn't exist.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would implode.
Yeah, yeah.
Shrivel up and die.
I mean, what about yourself, Heidi? I mean, you've spoken on here a little bit in the past that obviously the whole running the business element and doing all the pottery, you got seriously ill because of that. The physical and mental toll on your body was enough that your body said, you need to stop now. And because you're not, I'm going to make you stop. And, you know, I think this time round you've kind of reined it in a little bit and given yourself more time and recognize more signs of when your body's telling you, hey, you need to stop now.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that wasn't just the amount of time that I was spending in the pottery. I was maintaining a full-time job that required a good bit of travel. I was really physical with my job, super stressful. I was doing large sort installs for graphics, and so I was on ladders all the time, and it just, it was a lot. And then I would come home absolutely just wrecked from that and tired. And, you know, maybe I had been in a different state in the United States for the entirety of the week. And then I'd come home and I'd have to like work in the studio. And then I'd push myself in the studio because I didn't have any time during the week where I was, you know, getting anything done. So then I was, oh, well, you know, I have commitments. I need to get things done. And I think I made some changes before my body decided to yell at me. I saw the signs leading up to when I was getting sick, before I got sick, and made some major adjustments with my career. But in the same, I still was kind of burning the midnight oil, so to speak. And, you know, talking with my doctor and everything, stress is really weird because even though I wasn't stressed out when I eventually got sick, like I wasn't manic when I got sick, I actually thought I was doing really well by that point. I think we even talked on the podcast, like how good I felt. And then all of a sudden I got this nerve illness called shingles that just attacked me. Yeah. And because I was compromised, you know, from being sick with like a cold or whatever, it just, it took over. And it was a really long uphill battle to get better. You know, it's nothing to ignore when your body is starting to give you those signals of like, I don't think I'm getting enough sleep, or, you know, my shoulder's hurting really bad. Like I remember like before that happened, I had a cold shoulder, a frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
And that took a couple of months to fix. And that was during the time that I was, you know, really heavily doing this job. And I remember Rasmus, you even cautioned me. You were like, I think you need to slow it down a little bit. Like, this is crazy. And, you know, some people like myself are, it's fine. I'll be fine.
You're right. I'll be fine. I've been fine like this since I was 21. What could possibly go wrong?
I'm not 21 anymore. Double that. Shit.
I think it's an interesting thing. You know, your motivations to sell, your motivations to do things. I was questioned the other day, why are you doing two full-time jobs? And I sort of looked at them really confused. It's like, I don't do two full-time jobs. What are you talking about? And they're like, you 100% do two full-time jobs. So, well, no, I don't, because, you know, I'm at work Monday to Friday, whatever the shift pattern is, let's say Monday to Friday. There isn't physically enough time for me to do a second full-time job. And they were like, okay, so how much relaxing time a week do you actually do? Mm-hmm. And you have to sit there and you think about it. And they're like, because all we hear you talk about is you're either here, or if you're not in your workshop, you're emailing someone on your lunch break, you're on the phone to someone on your lunch break, you're organizing things, there's the admin, there's the website update, there's the social media, there's the podcast recording, there's the other things. So like most people, do you realize, go home and like make a meal and maybe watch some TV or play a computer game or read a book, or go out and socialize with people, or go dancing, or go and do a hobby that isn't the thing that you're doing as a business. And I sort of sat there and really thought about it. I was like, yeah, but I still don't do two full-time jobs because there's not enough physical time in the day.
You were too literal. You're being too literal.
I absolutely am too literal. And I've had to consciously now, I've kind of really made sure that unless there is a deadline that I haven't allowed myself time to finish the job previously, Sunday is 100% my day of rest. Mm. I do not go into the workshop. I don't do admin. I might look at a post from another person on social media, but I don't think about constructing my own. And the Sunday is my 100% day off from both jobs, and, you know, not taking it into account at all. So, but the motivation to sell element of that is you need to generate the revenue to allow yourself that time to then rest. Because if you underprice your work and you're having to work a 30-hour week on top of a 40-hour week that you already work in order to try and make it work, then it's not working. Okay. So work, can you think of the two definitions of work? People think of work as, oh, this is a negative, I have to go to work. And what is working? It is being a productive person, fulfilling a series of tasks. For your business to work, the task that your business should be doing is generating revenue to allow you to enjoy your craft. It is to generate revenue to allow you to expand the resources you have for your craft, whether that be machinery or materials or people to help you, or it is to generate revenue to allow you to have time where you don't have to go and earn money because it's there for you. So just think of the concept of work not as a positive thing. It's about, you know, work is a series of things that happen in order to reach an end goal. And again, we've spoken about goal setting. We've spoken about all of these different things in, you know, earlier series, but it all still remains just as relevant. And I think there are many motivations to sell things. And, you know, there's even the one of, I've got to move my workshop. I need to move some stock. I just need to get rid of it. That's not going to generate you revenue to do anything. It's like, pay me to take this rubbish away is the way someone told it to me once. And it's like, well, it shouldn't be classed as rubbish. But the reality is, if you've held on to it, but you don't hold any emotional value to it, and it's like, oh, these are kind of like my second grade stuff or whatever. It's like, well, in my case, if it's second grade stuff, I would normally burn it for warmth over the winter. If I'm moving, and which I probably will be later this year, then I'm not going to need that. Mm-hmm. Why would I pay to store material that I don't feel is good enough to sell in the hope that I might burn it in the future. I mean, that's ridiculous. So, you know, there might well be a whole pile of seconds or something at a market I do later this year that I'll just be like, hey, these are really cheap. But then we go back to the conversation that we've had of, but doesn't that devalue the rest of your work?
I have thoughts on that.
Go ahead, Rasmus.
This is mostly coming from me having the need of making money and at certain times being desperate to make money to make ends meet. Whereas, yeah, I have a pile of knife blades now that maybe they have some bad weld in them. Like you can see the weld line. They're not dangerous to use. They're not faulty in any other way except for kind of aesthetics. But if someone were to order from my website and it's like, it looks like a crack in it, I was like, yeah, my customer wouldn't be happy with that. But bringing those to a market, marking them as seconds, and basically taking donations for them, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
Also, it's kind of like every once in a while, there's people who actually really want some pieces of my work, but they can't pay the full price.
Yeah.
Or they're asking for like, hey, do you have something that's like B stock or seconds, like you say? And go like, yeah, I have some of that. Here you go. Have your pick. Pay whatever you feel like, but do pay for it. Because getting something in return for it means that they hopefully will actually value it a bit more. And I recoup some of the cost I had in making it.
Yeah.
Even if it's just materials, but it's still like, I don't mind giving it things away for free. But then it should be a gift I give, not something you ask for.
Yeah.
If you come to me and go like, oh, can I have this? And it's in the literal scrap bucket, and yes. But if it looks vaguely like reasonable stock I'm already selling, it's kind of like, you can pay for it, but there should be a transaction here.
and just to say, and this would be controversial for some people, a transaction of value does not include, oh, well, I'm an influencer on social media and I'll post about this and then you'll get loads of sales.
Yeah, because...
In my mind, if we're going down that route and you say, oh, you want me to give you a nice top-end piece in order for you to do that, that's like one of many so that I have others to sell. Okay, that's fine. You're allowed to hold it and take a picture or do a video with it. Then you give it back. And once I've sold another three, you can have that one.
Yeah. That's a good one.
So therefore, there is a defined response to that. There is a defined, I have had value from you having that interaction. Or you buy it. You know, that's it, isn't it, really?
Money is a very silly thing, but it's also a really easy way to measure how much people actually care. Because a lot of people do care about money. So if you have someone that go like, hey, I want to buy this and I would like to feature it on whatever channel I have, is that okay? Then, yeah. Excellent. Yeah. But if people come and beg for free just because they need content from you, that seems weird to me.
No, that's making you a resource.
Yeah.
That's really what it comes down to. It's like, I want to be able to talk about this thing, but I also really like it. So
I think all of us agree that we enjoy doing our crafts because we enjoy the relationships we get out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because we want to make the money. Like, especially for me, it's kind of like, yeah, I've been in a position where I need to make the money, but I keep doing the craft because I like the relationships I get from the craft.
Yeah. Well, I also like the challenges. Like, I had a guy come into the day job last week, or he rang up last week and said, I've got a trophy and I need someone to make an extra base for it so that we can fit more little metal plaques on with names as the years go on. Do you know anyone who can do that? I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. And in my head, I'm thinking of this, it's really nice, elaborate piece of like walnut where I'm going to do like some flared shapes and whatever else. And he brings the trophy in and it's kind of nice trophy. I said, so what do you want? He said, what I want is a disc with really flat sides so they can easily hammer these pieces of metal to it. And then this bit will just slot into the top. And then I will fit that. I will glue that in at some point so you don't have to do that. Okay. Do you want some finish on it or whatever? Oh, yeah, you can make it look nice. Just whatever you feel like. Right. What about the bottom? Do you want me to leave it as it is? Would you like me to stick some bays onto it at least to kind of, yeah, if you want, how much would it be? And it was like, oh, okay. But at the same time, whilst it was a very small commission and, you know, I've made it, it took me the time that it took me and he's going to pay the price I asked, which is lovely. It was the realization and the almost removing of that romantic vision I had in my head of, oh yeah, the base of a trophy, oh, that'd be really cool. I'll do like that, da, da, da. It's like, yeah, but you've got to remember the actual functionality of what it is. This is one that's going to be reused year after year after year. So it needs to be able to fit this on it. But it also made me realize I haven't reached out to like trophy engravers and trophy sellers and given them my cards and told them, hey, by the way, you know, like I can do this thing for you, which, you know, is difficult to find. So that's opening a whole other potential market for me now. I've got to go out and contact people for it. But that simple thing, which is a paid for transactional relationship, has then ticked a box for me where I've got that weird list in the back of my head of like, oh, it'd be cool to do something to do with the trophy. Okay. So now that item on the list has changed of, oh, you've done the initial one. Now what would be cool is if you get asked to make a trophy. Okay. Which is the massive change from it. And so it's those kind of the different jobs that you get brought to you, the different kind of things that motivate you to go, okay, there is an intrinsic value to what I'm about to do. I'm going to have to guess roughly at what it is, and I'm going to have to say, what's your budget? And I'm going to have to try and stick to that budget. But you also have to recognize this is something I've not done before, that there's going to be a bit of leeway in that. Because if it takes me longer, you're going to have to pay for that, because this isn't a thing for me. This is a thing for you. But then the value to yourself is getting to play with something different, or getting to do something you would never have considered before, or pushing you to do something that you've known you should always try, but you possibly haven't done. Like in my case, turning a sphere, which is a really tricky thing. And then having to try and turn a matching one, which I didn't fully succeed on, but the customer was very happy. So, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So then we need to have some wrap-up comments, and my brain is failing due to the time of day. So we're going to look up wrap-up comments. Okay. Oh, there we go. That's something that was scribbled down. A sold piece is a piece that is living its intended life.
Oh, that's nice.
It is nice, isn't it? It is a thing. I wish I'd come up. A sold piece is something that is living its intended life. So whether or not that has a function like a knife, like Rasmus was describing, or a bowl or a mug or anything like that, or whether it's just something that's hung on the wall, currently got something I'm looking at, care instructions to look after yourself. You think of the little label you've got on clothing and all that kind of stuff, like the way to look after it. Someone created this, and it's, drink water. Smile, show you care, go outdoors, read a book, focus on today, all of that kind of stuff. And that's something then that someone's bought, it's hung on the wall, and it's a little reminder to yourself. So its function is more psychological than anything else, but it's where it should be. It's hung on the wall in this house, not sat on a rack with 10 others waiting for someone to pay for it.
Yeah.
We're going to stop there in that really blunt way today. We're going to stop there. And if you want to listen to more, then we are going to carry on recording for the Patreon after show. As I mentioned earlier, that's something you can subscribe to. Alternatively, you can just wait for the next episode to come out, or go back through and listen all over again to the previous 5 seasons. What's the best way that you can reward us for this long time that you've had us speaking in your ears? Best way is to tell other people about us. It's free. It's a cheap way of doing it. You don't have to give us any money. Tell other people, hey, you make things too. Maybe you should listen to this podcast. I think you'd find it helpful. Maybe leave us a review on one of your podcast apps, all of that kind of stuff. It would be really helpful to all of us, and we do appreciate it. If you want to reach out to us, if you want to speak to us more, you can find us at Setting Up Shop, shop spelled S-H-O-P-P-E, on social media. We have a website, info@settingupshop.com is our email address. And if you want to reach out to us individually, you can find me, Terence.co.uk. You can find Heidi at Whitehall_pottery on Instagram. And you can find Rasmus at Rasmus Learn. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. And my voice hasn't sent you to sleep. Bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.